Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Mayor Joseph Petty of Worcester decried the loss of beds and services from St. Vincent Hospital today as a nurses' strike started in March wears on. Petty asserted the nearly 700 nurses are being, quote, prevented, unquote, from returning to work by the actions of the hospital. Now, the hospital and the nurses reached a contract agreement in mid-August, but when the hospital notified the striking nurses they would not all be guaranteed their old jobs, the process broke down again and has since been at a standstill. Today, Petty called the move by the hospital unprecedented. Now, we talked to both the hospital and a representative for the nurses just as things broke down in August. We have both parties back today. Today, we begin with Carolyn Jackson, the CEO of St. Vincent Hospital in Worcester. Carolyn, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So, Carolyn, a little more from the mayor of Worcester today. He accused St. Vincent of violating practices that are standard in, quote, any and all strikes, end quote. And he was, of course, referring to Tenet Healthcare's proposed return to work agreement, which does not guarantee that nurses returning from the strike can go back to their old positions. How do you respond to the mayor's accusations?
So in your lead-in, you mentioned that the mayor calls the strike unprecedented, and I would agree with that statement, and I would also agree that our return-to-work agreement is not standard. The strike is unprecedented. It was based
So I'm going to stop you there because I was saying that the mayor referred to the hospital's move as unprecedented, not the nurse's strike.
Okay. I am sorry.
Okay.
So the strike is, my words, the strike is unprecedented. The strike is the longest nurses' strike in the state of Massachusetts. It became number one a few weeks ago when it crossed roughly the six-month mark. And because of that, there are a lot of unprecedented things going on. For strikes that last a day, a week, or even a couple of weeks, people would not, hospitals or organizations would not hire permanent replacement workers. However, when a strike drags on as long as this one has, and it will be 7 months old next week, the employer needs to take actions to stabilize its workforce and to make sure that it continues to operate to the best extent that it can.
So you have hired those replacement nurses. They've been in place.
Correct.
Is there some reason that when nurses who had struck come back, you would not be able to continue to have smooth operations with them in their old jobs and their old shifts?
So if we brought all of the striking nurses back to their old jobs and their old shifts, then we would displace potentially 205 permanent replacement nurses who have been hired since May.
So, but either way, you're going to have some people who could be displaced. Why the priority for the replacement nurses versus the original? And the reason I'll ask is I know you're aware that the nurses are claiming that this is specifically retaliation for striking.
This is absolutely not retaliation. We were very public and open about our decision to hire permanent replacement nurses. We waited a full 2 months after the strike began to even begin the hiring process. We were open and honest about it. The M&A ridiculed our efforts and said we weren't going to be able to hire nurses, and in fact, we did hire nurses. And we did so because the travel nurses were becoming more difficult to maintain a stable group of because of the fact that COVID began accelerating in other parts of the country.
So I'm going to stay with this for a minute longer. I hear what you're saying. If the argument is retaliation, if we know that in a healthcare staffing shortage, everybody can get jobs somewhere, how does it not look like retaliation if it is standard practice in shorter strikes? And I'll use shorter because that was your assertion about what the difference is here. If standard practice in shorter strikes is to allow people to return to their old jobs, I mean, can you not see how that looks like retaliation for striking?
So I disagree that that looks like retaliation, and in fact, it is not retaliation. In a short strike, you wouldn't need to hire any permanent replacement nurses, nor would you have the time to do so. The duration of the strike has necessitated that we hire nurses to stabilize the workforce. The M&A had told us at the beginning, or stated at the beginning, they wanted to be out through the summer, and we could not continue to function with exclusively travel nurses throughout that time. And so we did what we needed to do to make sure that we were able to provide care for the citizens of Worcester and beyond.
Okay, so MNA, just for listeners, is the Massachusetts Nurses Association. So you may know that State Representative David H.A. LaBeouf, who represents Worcester, called on Tenet Healthcare to replace you with a senior representative from their headquarters in Dallas to get this finalized. Have you heard from Dallas since then, and is that something that might happen?
So we have had senior executives from the company involved in negotiations since July. We had our head of workforce relations as well as the company's chief nursing officer at the bargaining table with the M&A throughout July and August, and they were there when talks broke down. And all executives in the company from Worcester to Dallas will state that we are going to stick by the 205 brave nurses who decided to take positions and care for patients during this pandemic.
So for you, unless the striking nurses accept the return to work as is, there's no movement.
That is not accurate. And in fact, we have reached out to the M&A on multiple occasions, three in particular since August 20th, to talk to them about creative solutions. We've offered three creative solutions for striking nurses whose positions have been replaced. The first one is we will guarantee every striking nurse a position, and we would offer any open position within the facility for them to move into. Secondly, if they don't want to do that, we would offer them super seniority rights. So if the person who took their position does leave within a year after the strike ends, that nurse would go immediately back into their old position regardless of seniority. And then the third option is we have offered an enhanced severance package for nurses who don't want either of those options. And we have told the M&A's attorney on three occasions, on the 20th and of August and September 7th via phone, as well as on the 26th of August in writing, that we are willing to discuss any creative solution that does not involve forcibly removing the permanent replacement nurses.
Okay.
And the M&A has been unwilling to discuss any creative solutions.
So very briefly, before we let you go, do you have concerns that in a global pandemic that this is creating strain and safety risks for people who need health care?
We are doing the absolute best we can with our travel nurses, our permanent replacement nurses, and our crossing nurses to provide the absolute best health care we can for all of the people who we can possibly provide it for.
All right. That was Carolyn Jackson, the CEO of St. Vincent Hospital in Worcester. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you.
So we turn now to Marlena Pellegrino. She is a nurse currently on strike at St. Vincent's Hospital and the co-chair of the bargaining unit of the Massachusetts Nurses Association. Marlena, appreciate you joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you have been critical of Tenet Healthcare and St. Vincent's. Obviously, this is a tough, nasty standoff. What are your responses to the creative solutions that we just heard Carolyn Jackson, CEO of St. Vincent's, lay out? Have they laid those solutions out to you, and how has the Massachusetts Nurses Association responded?
First of all, I'll say that I've been at every negotiation session, including the last several, and the solutions that she refers to are not in writing. We have the return to work agreement I have in front of me. We shared it with all of our 700 members. So those creative solutions, so-called, have not been put forth to us in writing.
And would it make a difference if they were? Would you be able to bring them to the group of nurses striking if they were put in writing?
I'll say that the point of a return to work agreement, when you get to the point where we are in negotiations in a long strike like this, that's been very, very challenging. You get to that point, which we reached on August 16th when we met with the hospital. It's a time to start the healing process. It's a time to look back, and we did achieve some staffing language in the last agreement that the hospital put forth, and we were ready on that day to take that step, very inches away from having a tentative agreement, which would put us back at the bedside.
So, Marlena, I'm just going to have you pause for a second. I can tell that phone is distracting you, and I want you to be able to give us your full attention. Do you want to mute that? Or I know it happens. This is live radio. This happens. Let me let you mute that so that you can have your full attention.
Okay.
Okay.
There we go.
Okay.
Sorry
so that's okay. Oh, there it goes again. All right. So listen, let's try to stay with this. I imagine that things are quite busy today, given what's going on. So you were talking about the return to work. We covered, you know, sort of the pushback on the return to work and our lead into Carolyn Jackson. The place I want to go next with you is the unfair labor practices. So the nurses have filed complaints of unfair labor practices against the hospital. An email comes to WBUR at the end of August. The hospital claimed those filings are a common practice because a finding in your favor would automatically require them to fire the replacement nurses. And they went on to say that, quote, one of your claims was that the, quote, the hospital committed an unfair labor practice by not providing the names and addresses of the permanent replacement nurses, end quote. Why would you want the names and addresses of the permanent replacement nurses? It seems like there could be opportunity for harassment or pushback on them.
No, I mean, that would not be the case at all. And I think the reason to have the names and the addresses, or the names at least, is we're trying to figure out exactly where the nurses, many of the nurses have come from the inside. They've been moved from one position to another. So talking about the return to work agreement, what's important to note of the return to work agreement is that the hospital's position is putting very less senior nurses and less experienced nurses into positions.
Just forge right ahead. Stay with me. Just forge ahead.
Yes, into positions that are held by the most senior nurses in the building. So at this point, you would have nurses with 20, 30, 40 years of experience in very highly skilled areas of the hospital replaced by novice nurses or nurses with less experience.
Okay, so let's pick up on that for a second, Marlena, because in a statement to the media on August 19th, Tenet Healthcare estimated that about 85% of returning nurses could get their exact jobs and shifts back. While the remaining 15%, they said, quote, we have committed to working with the Massachusetts Nurses Association to try and resolve these situations, end quote. Why isn't 85% enough? That's a huge percentage. Why is that not enough?
It's not the percentage that is the problem. It's the nurses that would be replaced are the most senior and the most expert in the building. So you have nurses with 35 years of experience, as an example, who have been assisting delivering babies and labor and delivery for 35 years, being replaced by a novice or new grad nurse. You have nurses who are working in a cardiac catheterization lab for many, many years, which takes critical care skills replaced by, if the hospital were to receive their return to work agreement, with novice nurses. The point of the return to work agreement is not just to return us to our previous positions because we just need those previous positions. It's about patient safety. So why wouldn't you want to have your nurses with the most experience, the most seniority, who have been working for decades in these positions, caring for patients?
So let's stay on the patient.
There's room for everyone in the building. But standard, you bring your nurses back to those. When you want to start a healing process, when you want to end a strike, and you don't want to continue the battle with a different agenda, then you agree to a return to work agreement that has your most expert and senior nurses in their positions.
So let's stay with that.
Hospital.
Let's stay with that, Marlena, because I know you're aware. So, for example, Governor Baker tweeted on the 24th, the Commonwealth needs every available healthcare resource fully operational while we are responding to this pandemic. It's time for both sides to get back to the table and reach consensus at St. Vincent Hospital. Concern from the governor to the mayor of Worcester that patient care, patient safety is at risk because of the standoff as well. So how do you square that part of the circle?
We absolutely agree. We have over 600 nurses out on the sidewalk walking the picket line, wanting to be back at the bedside. That's our main goal. We know that our patients are waiting for us. We hear from our patients on a weekly and daily basis as they come out of the hospital contacting us. So that's our goal, is to get back at the bedside. We are dealing with a company that is using retaliatory measures in their return to work agreement. I say, put that aside. This is time for a change in leadership. It's a time for people to act as mature adults here and get this done.
So, Marlena, you probably heard. You probably heard Carolyn Jackson say that this was an unprecedented strike in its length, and as a result, since it wasn't a shorter strike, it would be unfair for the replacement nurses to lose their jobs. What is your response? I mean, you're all nurses, so what is your response to that?
My response is the reason it's unprecedented, the strike shouldn't have had to go on strike to begin with. But the reason it's unprecedented is Tenet Healthcare Corporation and Carolyn Jackson has spent over $100 million to prolong the strike over these many months. We never wanted to be out this long. We didn't want to be out to begin with. We had to take a stand to advocate for our patients, for their safety, for their care, for the many years of dedication that we've given that hospital. So they spent the money on the replacement nurses. They spent the money on the security cameras and the details. And a lot of resources were used. Instead of bringing the parties back to the table to get nurses back to the bedside, they've used every measure they could, including millions and millions of dollars, to prolong the strike and keep us out on the street.
All right.
And it's time for that to stop.
Marlene, I'm going to take it back there. Thank you so much. That was Marlene Pellegrino. She's a nurse currently on strike at St. Vincent Hospital and the co-chair of the bargaining unit of the Massachusetts Nurses Association. Really appreciate your time. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.
The MBTA says it is still investigating why a Red Line train car jumped the tracks at the Broadway station in South Boston yesterday. This after an ascending escalator at Back Bay Station suddenly reversed direction Sunday, sending dozens of people, according to eyewitnesses, tumbling down. Witnesses say there were people on the ground below, there was blood, 9 people were sent to the hospital. And it begs the question, what exactly is going on with the T? To help us sort through that, we have a couple of our favorite transportation experts and you. We invite you to join the conversation. Are you worried about the quality of the T's infrastructure? Were you affected by any of these recent incidents on the T? Or maybe you used the T, used to ride it more often and you've stopped. What do you need to see to come back? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And now on to our guests. We have Jim Aloisi, a former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation and a board member of the group Transit Matters, as well as Dan McNichol, who is an infrastructure advocate and former chief spokesperson for the Big Dig. Jim, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
And Dan, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Tiziana.
So there's undoubtedly a pattern I want to get at here, but I want to start by taking the incidents one by one. Jim, were you surprised to hear about this latest Red Line derailment yesterday?
Well, sure, you're always surprised when an event like that happens. But, you know, saying that obviously belies a truth that we've all known for a long time, which is we have a very old system that is chronically underfunded, and the T is doing its best on a regular basis to play catch up on maintenance issues. And I think, you know, we have to expect that things will happen, just like things happen on the roadway system every day that don't get this much attention. Things will happen as the T begins to work its way through the long list of overdue maintenance and state of good repair needs that this old system needs, right? So is it a surprise? It's always a surprise, but in a way it's not a surprise because we know what we're dealing with, right?
Yeah.
The good news on the Red Line, I don't believe anyone was injured on the Red Line incident yesterday, but obviously the T is investigating it. It needs to be resolved. The T does have, thanks to commitments made by the former and the current administration, there are new Red Line trains being manufactured as we speak, but it's that those things will take time. So, and we all have to be patient as the T works through these things.
So, Jim, I just briefly, because then I do want to get over to Dan as well, but just briefly, you're talking about those new Red Line cars. There were some in service. They are now not in service because the MBTA is investigating the cause of a slow-speed derailment in one of the new Orange Line trains, but they are expected to be in service by 2024. In a word or two, would that solve the problem?
Well, it might have solved yesterday's problem. Again, I don't, you know, everyone, we need to figure out what was the cause of it. Was it a signal and track issue? Was it an equipment issue? We don't know the answer to that. But certainly new Red Line trains will do a number of things. They will be more reliable. They'll provide riders with more comfort and more confidence in their ride. I am a Red Line user. Broadway Station, where the incident happened yesterday, is my station. That's where I get on and that's where I get off because of where I live. And so I have confidence in the system. I use it regularly. I'll be on it tomorrow. I'll be on it Friday. Yes, those new trains will be helpful. But in the meantime, I'm convinced, and I want to say this as clearly as I can as a former state official, I'm convinced that the system is safe. It's safe in connection with the pandemic. It's safe in connection with this, the overall system. events will occur. They're not events that anyone wants to see happen, but it's important that riders know and have the confidence that the system is safe and that they can use that system safely.
Okay, so now I'm going to turn to you, Dan, and I'm going to add into this the escalator incident. And I'm going to have Jim's emphasis on the fact that he believes the system is safe echoing in the back of my head. The details of this particular incident are pretty horrific. Sunday, an escalator at Back Bay going up to the commuter rail platform reverses direction at high speed. So there are people on it. They plunge backward towards the bottom. As we mentioned, witnesses say the injured piled up, that there was a great deal of blood. The T said the escalator had been inspected in July by the contractor KONE. And I want to say, we did reach out to the T. We invited them to join us today. They were unable to, but they did give us a statement. Dan, I'm going to give you a bit of that statement, then I'm going to ask you for your reactions here. So the annual inspection of the Back Bay escalator took place in July 2021, and the unit was state certified. In addition to regular routine maintenance, this escalator had what's called a, quote, check for basic operation on 9-7-21, 8-5-21, 7-21-21, 6-11-21, 5-5-21, and so on every month. Under a contract with the MBTA, KONE regularly inspects and maintains the T's 177 escalators system-wide. So that's the response from the T. Your reactions to this, and where do we situate it in this larger picture of these accidents, Dan?
I am not surprised by the accidents that are continuing to pile up. We've seen Orange Line trains smoking. We've seen horrible derailments, and we saw a low-speed derailment on the Red Line. Professor David Jones fell to his death on a stairwell at JFK. This small girl, according to an eyewitness, had her face mauled on the escalator. Her mother's head was partially removed from the scalp, is according to a news report of a live witness on TV. So these things, to me, are shocking every time they happen, but I'm not surprised that they're happening, if that can be. It's horrible, especially as a new father, to think of Professor David Jones's three children. Their life is forever changed horribly, and his grieving widow. So it's dramatic in the most horrific way. It's very real. It's not acceptable. And my biggest fear, Tiziana, is that we're becoming so accustomed to these accidents that we're accepting them. We're accepting the decrepitude. We're accepting the filth. We're accepting the unreliable service, the delays that turn into people, essential workers now, especially during the pandemic, trying to get to work. And that just throws the entire transportation system, all of the transportation systems in Boston, into chaos. When you have an escalator going backwards or you have a train derailing, it's a ripple effect every single time.
So as a matter of so I want to pick up on that. So Dan, bear with me for a minute. So that accustomedness, which is not really a word, I want to pick up on that. I do want to clarify for our listeners that the staircase that Professor David Jones fell down, and it was a tragedy, but I want to clarify, it was blocked off as dangerous in early 2020. It was blocked off at the bottom and at the top. And the Boston Globe has done some great reporting on confusion about who had stewardship and responsibility for that staircase as well, which is kind of part of the bureaucratic picture here. All right, so here's what I want to do. I have another voice I'm going to bring in a minute. But Jim and Dan, I want to hear a little more from the two of you together on this question of whether we have become complacent with underinvestment, and if so, what one does to fix that. So, Jim, your response to that assertion by your sense to that assertion by Dan.
I haven't become complacent, and I don't think no one I know is accepting the substandard financing of the T or the conditions of the T. But let's have a candid conversation about why the T is underfunded, right? And you can look no farther than Beacon Hill, right? The legislature continues not to provide the T with the funding it needs. The governor continues to provide the T without the funding it needs. And so the T can only do what it can do with the resources it has. And I think that we all need to have a candid conversation, because I've been having it since 2009. About the need to raise significant net new revenue for the MBTA and not necessarily on the capital side, but on the operating side, so that he can hire more qualified and professional resources to come in and do the job that needs to be done, particularly in connection with maintenance. And so I would say very clearly, no one accepts the status quo. I advocate every day. I spend a part of every day working, advocating for a better MBTA. But the complacency, if it exists, it exists with the decision makers who have it in their power to change the direction of how we spend our money in Massachusetts, okay, and to spend it in a way that supports a safer, more sustainable public transportation system.
Okay, so I'm going to bring in another voice here for a minute. Mella Bush Miles is the director of transit-oriented development and at the T Riders Union and the T Riders Union at Alternatives for Environment and Community. Mella, do we have you?
Yes, I am here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Welcome back. Mella, what reactions are you hearing from riders after the escalator incident and then the red line derailment?
Fear and trepidation. Shock and total fear of what is going on. And also some of the questions that folks have been asking is, where is the control board? Why hasn't the governor appointed a new control board so that we can have be able to speak to issues at the board meetings as we have done for so long in the past? There is no control board. It has not been installed. It's been gone since June 30th, and we're about to be in October. And it was a year over since its life already of 3 to 5 years. It was extended with no succession plan.
Mella, without without that board in place, do you have other venues to be in communication with the MBTA leadership and with the governor about needs and demands?
We advocate through working with our state legislators. We do not have a front-facing voice to meet directly with them.
And Mella, what do riders that you're working with right now most need to hear and see from the MBTA leadership and from the governor?
We need someone to speak to. Second of all, we need to understand that people are injured in other ways other than when there is a derailment, for example. People are injured economically because the MBTA does divert buses to shuttle, the subway riders back and forth. And so then people who are waiting for buses, their buses do not show up because T doesn't have extra buses.
So it's an equity issue.
So there's economic injury that does occur. We don't want to get that twisted. But also, we know that we see other crumbling areas all over the MBTA system. Ruggle station stairs are raggedy and falling apart. There's holes in platforms on the commuter rail level. There are a number of other locations where we see the T falling into disrepair, and people are scared. I take the T, and I'm very nervous now to get on an escalator. I will take the stairs and increase my cardio workout because I'm just not going to get on an escalator.
All right.
Also, one last thing that I wanted to say in my research, in 2015 in the Focus 40 report, there was information about escalators, and it said that 64% of the escalators are 6 years past their useful life. This was stated 64% are past their useful life, and now it's 6 years later since then. So there is a problem.
Mel, I'm going to take it. I'm going to have to thank you there. And thank you. And thank you for bringing up the Focus 40 report. We'll double check those numbers from 2015. Mella, thank you. That is Mella Bush Miles, Director of Transit Oriented Development and the T Riders Union at Alternatives for Environment and Community. Just in our remaining time, Dan, I want to come back to you, former spokesperson for the Big Dig. Mella raising concerns about the absence of a governing board right now, 3 months waiting for Governor Baker to make nominations and put that in place. Talking about fear, what is the accountability moment and where does it have to happen right now, Dan?
I'd go a step further than Jim, and I agree. Beacon Hill is responsible for a lot of the problems, but leadership is absent. Politicians follow, they do not lead. the responsibility really is ours, Tiziana. It's the public that should not tolerate, that must demand. I'm looking for the outrage, and we're not seeing it. I fear for the system because I think we continue to limp along.
Let me just engage with you on that, Dan, for a second. Mela sounded mad.
Mela did sound
outraged.
But Mela's one vote, and you need a collective movement. You need people that are not about transit, that are actually on the Pike or on I-93, to say, yeah, my best friends are the people riding the T because they get off the highway. And, you know, just looking at that stairwell, DCR, MBTA, finger pointing, everybody's responsible, so nobody's responsible. Why wasn't it repaired? Why wasn't it replaced? Why wasn't it demolished? And I just think we're going to see more of this, not less, because the funding is not there, the leadership is not there, and the demand for a better infrastructure is not there. We have the infrastructure, I'm afraid, that we deserve.
All right, Jim, last question to you in just a couple sentences. Sorry, I'm up against the clock here. If you had the governor's ear and were advising him, what would you tell him he needs to do today?
What the governor needs to do today is call on the legislature like he did in 2015 to an emergency effort to think about how to increase and provide stable additional funding for the MBTA's operating budget, not to rely on fares because fares are inadequate and we know that they're not sustainable, but to find new sources that meet his own laudable goals of decarbonizing the transportation system in Massachusetts by 2050. He can do that, and that can be part of his legacy. I hope he considers that would be something that all of us would applaud.
All right. That is Jim Aloisi, former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation and a board member of the group Transit Matters, alongside Dan McNichol, an infrastructure advocate and former chief spokesperson for the Big Dig. He has a new book on New York's Second Avenue subway coming out in the spring. Jim, thanks.
You're welcome.
Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tiziana.
I love the fall. Don't you? It is the leaves. It's those shades. I just love the colors. Red, yellow, that burnt orange is probably my favorite. And no tree does fall color like a New England tree. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to pretend that we're jumping around in the leaves right now. Are you going to go on a foliage trip this fall? What do you like most about it? And do you have questions on a plan that trip? Where to go? Maybe you have a favorite place and you want other people to go there and see the leaves this year. Call us and join the conversation. 800-423-8255. That is 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. So we want to get a look for what we can expect. Is it going to be a good one this year? So we're going to start with WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein. Dave, is it going to be a good one for leaves?
Well, I think all years are good. I think some years are just better than others. You know, to your point, fall is for a lot of people a favorite season, and we always are going to have color. There's never going to be a year where the leaves don't change. But I do think that this year they're going to be quite brilliant. We've had adequate precipitation, and the leaves are really full on the trees from all the growth this year.
So you wrote about why leaves change color in the fall, and frankly, I thought it was fascinating. I had no idea. Can you give us sort of the nutshell version of that?
Sure. So during the course of the year, when the leaves are green, for the most part, most of our trees are green, you're seeing all the chlorophyll, and the chlorophyll gives it the green color. But there's a couple of colors underneath the chlorophyll. The yellow and the orange are present, but we don't see them because the chlorophyll is just too brilliant, so it doesn't shine through. As the days get shorter and the temperatures start to fall, we begin to see the chlorophyll not working as well, and now we start to see the colors that are underneath come through. What's interesting, and that's kind of the story that we're told as little kids, but what's interesting is that we have the red color underneath that really develops because of the cold weather. So the red's not present. It actually forms, and it's the same red that forms when an apple turns red over the course of the fall as well.
That's so cool. Okay, so last question on that. Will a leaf turn the same color every year, like a particular leaves falling off? I mean, that's not the same leaf, obviously. But off a maple tree, is it going to be the same colors every year, or does it vary?
It does vary somewhat. So some years a tree might be a little more orangey red than others. Some they might be a little more yellowy orange, but in general, the maples are going to turn that orange-red color. The ashes, for example, are going to turn more yellow. The aspens would turn more yellow. So there's a palette that the trees have, but that palette has subtle differences depending on adequate moisture, the temperature, and all of that.
All right, final question. When will peak leaf peeping be in eastern Massachusetts this year, do you think?
So I have a little pet peeve about the question, and it's not directed at you.
I can
and
take
here's
it.
The thing, here's the thing about peak. So everybody wants to have peak. When's peak? And I always say, don't get FOMO for foliage, because the reality is that the colors change over the course of the season in a very slow way. So if you want to see more reds and oranges, then earlier in the season is great for the lower maples, things that are in swamps and places like that. If you want to see more of the yellows or some of those darker burnt oranges, you might want to wait a little later. So the season itself starts to run as early as this weekend, and it runs all the way through November. Generally, most of the leaves will have changed by the time we get to the third week in October around Greater Boston or even early November. But before that is great, and after that is great. Don't necessarily look for what's peak, because when we get to peak, a lot of leaves have dropped their leaves already.
Well, that was handy, because I love the yellows and burnt oranges, so now I know when to look. That is WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein. Hey, Dave, thanks.
You're welcome.
So you heard Dave. Lots of different ways you can see leaves. Where are you going? Are you a leaf peeper? Are you planning a trip? Where's your favorite place? Or do you have questions about how to make it a great trip? 800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have a couple of guests to have some fun with us on this. Jeff and Lisa Folger. They have traveled around New England and documented foliage for years. So much so, they actually have the nicknames Mr. and Mrs. Foliage. Jeff and Lisa join us now. Jeff, Lisa, or Mr. and Mrs. Foliage, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
All right, so Lisa, I understand you just came back from a foliage trip to Maine. Where did you go and how was it?
We went around the Flagstaff Lake area, driving all around the lake, and it was amazing. We've been to Rangeley, but we hadn't explored Flagstaff. So it was all new for us.
So, Jeff, I'm going to back up for a second because I do have to ask. I mean, Mr. and Mrs. Foliage, that's kind of like the claim, right, for leaf peeping. How did you guys get the names?
Well, Lisa married into it. I used to be a blogger for Yankee Magazine for a few years, you know, back in the early 2000s. Well, I was their first one. And they started calling me Jeff Foliage instead of Jeff Folger. It just sort of rhymed. And I ran with it, and I've stayed with it ever since. It just helped identify me, and people have, you know, grown accustomed to just calling me Jeff Foliage. And Lisa married into it,
and
so now,
you
know, it goes, yeah.
All right, so I understand that the two of you kind of share responsibilities on these incredible trips that you take. Jeff, you sort of pick where you think you're going to see the best foliage, and then Lisa, you turn it into kind of a thing. Is that right?
Yeah, I take where he tells me we're going to be going, and I research the places to stay and some things in the area to do, because he will photograph, you know, the good times early morning and late evening. But in the in between times, we like to find some fun things to do in the area.
Jeff, what makes an incredible foliage photo?
A lot of things. It can be the light that we're getting, early morning light, you know, right after dawn or just before dawn sometimes. But, you know, the quality of the light is what really can turn an average photograph, average composition into a really something special. The other morning we got up and the sun's light was just beginning to hit the horizon. We were out up above Flagstaff Lake, and just the warm nature of that light very early in the morning as it just comes across the mountains, it's just something to see. You have to be there at that time of the day to see what it does to the leaves.
I want to put the ask out to listeners one more time. Where have you seen the most beautiful leaves? Do you go looking for them in the fall? And what's that drive? Where do you go? Lisa, as I was listening to Jeff, you know, he's giving us the visual, but honestly, what I'm thinking about is the sounds of the leaves crunching and the smells, those damp smells of wet fall foliage with those beautiful colors. What has been your favorite place to see leaves and take in all of those sights and senses?
Oh my gosh, that's such a hard question to answer because there really are so many. I mean, this weekend was spectacular, seeing Flagstaff below. We were up high on a hill. We went to a new spot called, what was that on the top of the hill with the 360?
Quill Hill.
Quill Hill.
Which is, yeah, just north of Rangeley on 16. And that was something new. It was spectacular. Just, you could see for miles into Canada and
in New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire, yeah. and 360 degree view. It was amazing. It's my new favorite right now.
For at least 15 minutes.
Well, yeah. 1-800-423-8255 to share your favorite. And Jeff, if somebody wants to just get on the road, now I understand you guys really plan this out, but if somebody's in the greater Boston area, they've got time one weekend, they want to get on the road and just drive and see beautiful foliage. Is there a particular highway or route that you're like, get to, you know, 16, get to 93, that you recommend people find their way to?
Well, 93 is always great for getting somewhere fast, except maybe on Columbus Day weekend. Then 93 is not a good choice, but it tends to get like a parking lot going north. But, you know, going up through 93 through Franconia Notch, I love going up Route 16 through the into the White Mountains that way. It kind of reminded me always a little bit of Route 66, kind of quaint little towns that you go through, like Tamworth and Ossipee. And it's just really a fun way to go into, but not a fast way to go into the White Mountains. So it depends on if you have a need for speed, then you take 93. And you can meander up 100 different ways into the White Mountains to enjoy your trip up there.
Sounds like north is the way to go, though.
Yes, north is the way to go right now.
All right.
I would, yeah.
No, go ahead. You would.
Oh, I was going to say, right now, you know, well, forecasting forward, you know, this weekend, the best colors are up north. Northern Vermont in the Northeast Kingdom, northern New Hampshire, I would say still the best colors are from Route 26, Dixville Notch, north to the Canadian border, and northwestern Maine from, you know, all along Route 16, Route 26, Rangeley up into Carabasset Valley. All of those areas are going to be the best areas this coming weekend. Things are moving slow, but they are moving. And we're getting, as Dave said, cold temperatures coming in, and they had some frost last night. So things are going to be moving a little bit faster, I think, now.
800-423-8255. Susan in Rockland wants to share her favorite place. Hey there, Susan.
Hi. So my favorite place is the parking lot at my local Home Depot. There is
I love it.
There's a huge row of euonymus bushes, which turn this flaming red. And what I learned from those bushes is, I work construction, I drive into Home Depot, I race out again, going to whatever job site, and they taught me to just stop and look for just a minute before I put the car in drive. And so that's my favorite.
Oh, Susan, I love it. So these are the euonymus bushes at the Home Depot in or near Rockland.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I love that, right? So, yes, it's wonderful if you can get to the White Mountains, but you can also go to Home Depot and see beautiful foliage. So, Jeff, I had like seven thoughts crash into my head at once there. Jeff and Lisa, I think where I want to go next, I'm thinking about birders, and I'm thinking about the community of birders and how they share sightings of rare birds and they share locations with each other. Sometimes they're competitive. The two of you, you have a Facebook group, you have a website. There is a community of leaf peepers. What does that community do together? I mean, like, are you looking for certain rare leaves or foliage, or are you just sharing best places? How does that work, Lisa?
We're pretty much sharing best places. The group has evolved into people come on and ask, where's a good place to go? When I'm coming, and everybody in the group pitches in and gives ideas on places to go to see fall foliage or to see those overlooks where you can see the beautiful valleys covered in, you know, color. So that's basically, yeah. So that's really, it's really been a great thing. Our website, we really try to do the same, give suggestions on places that we've been that people can go. We always talk about a plan B. So, you know, if it's a bad day, a rainy day, or maybe the foliage is, it just isn't quite, you know, you've seen all you can see. What else is there to do? And we try to give suggestions on things like that.
So Alicia from Marston's Mills wants to add to that community's list of places to go. Alicia, go ahead.
Hi. I grew up out in the Berkshires in western Massachusetts. So the Appalachians run through there. And Mount Greylock is a beautiful place to see fall foliage. It's close to the border of Vermont, and it has just this massive, expansive view of the Appalachian Mountains and the whole valley in Berkshire County.
It sounds absolutely gorgeous. And is it do the leaves turn fairly early in the season there, Alicia, or late?
I would say they'll probably be turning probably soon. Not as early as Maine or New Hampshire, but usually kind of mid-October is a great time. But just the Berkshires in general is such a beautiful place to be any time of year, but especially in the fall.
All right. So Alicia says to add to your list Mount Greylock out in the Berkshires. So, Jeff, I want to come back. You know, we're having this conversation while we are still in a global pandemic. And we have returned to some levels of safe mobility. It does strike me, especially if you can day trip it, that this is a way to be out in the world during a pandemic that is safe and rejuvenating.
Definitely. You're out in the open air. There's a group over in Rutland, Vermont, Come Alive. They espouse the whole movement to get outside, enjoy the trails, and I've joined in with them, and we have a leaf peeper society for this comealive.org, and it's really something fun, but it's a safe way to get out there.
All right, that is Mr. and Mrs. Foliage, Jeff and Lisa Folger of Salem. Thank you both so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that's our show for today, folks. Thanks for tuning in to Radio Boston.